we're going to talk about the 45% offshore idea from an investment point of view. So it talks about all about broadening the opportunity set and how do you diversify, right, when we talk about this. And we have a gentleman here. I will not try to pronounce his surname. He told me I might injure myself as I almost did there. His name is Bastian. So Bastian joined Precinct Investment Management in August 2015, held a couple of roles before the very recent one, which actually seen him promoted to Chief Investment Officer. But he also spent some time in Europe, right? Over 10 years spent in Europe in the asset management space, worked in Switzerland as well as Hamburg. I think from Germany, right? I would imagine Bastian. So he's a gentleman who obviously has spent some time in offshore markets, and I think he would give some good insight in terms of how do we go about diversifying our portfolios in that way. So please help me welcome the Chief Investment Officer of Precinct, Bastian.
Thanks so much. Okay, thank you everybody for having me. Thanks for that very kind intro. But I would like you actually to try to pronounce my surname, if possible.
Oh, Bastian.
I'm joking. You know when you hear a money market fund manager speaking about focusing on the long term, that's when you know you're going through really interesting times. Okay, so back on to my intro. I just want to start by saying sorry for my German accent. I don't think Germany is heading towards hyperinflation, which is a scenario which we have spoken about right now, but I actually just want to say, thinking of my background, I'm not here as a tourist and not here just for the good weather. So I am actually proudly South African. I'm one of the few guys who went from Europe to South Africa, not the other way around, because I truly think this is actually the place to be. Okay, so to start off, we're going to speak the change in regulation, the change in regulation that we now can be 45% offshore. And we're going to take a couple of takes on that, what we think, what the implications are, what we think should change in investment portfolios. And before I start, I think it's important to highlight there's a lot of views around that. So I think after the regulation was announced on CityWire, I guess there was every day a new article on some managers staying local and some managers taking the full allocation and some managers ending up somewhere in between. So we're going to approach this through the prescient lens. So I'm not supposed to market any funds here, which we're not going to do. But the prescient lens is obviously very systematic, very academically backed up, and we always are going with the evidence. So we will focus on really the data and what the data suggests what to do. Okay, so to start off, a quick table of contents which we're going to cover today. We're going to start by speaking about, see if this actually works, it does. We're going to start with a quick synopsis. So what are the key takeaways? From there, I'm going to just highlight the changes which actually have happened and what it means and what we expect others to do. And then we're going to speak about now we need to take more assets offshore. So our take is you need to take more assets offshore. What are the challenges and what are the opportunities? And then one of the challenges will then be exchange rate risk. Okay, so now we have this very volatile rand, but if you exchange it against the dollar, it's obviously a very volatile currency pair. So how do we deal with it? Can one even deal with it? And what are the implications? And then we're going to speak about how we think a balanced fund. We're speaking about a high equity balance. I'm not going to say it's our balanced fund. It's not, but it's what we generally think a CPI plus six targeting asset class mix should be looking at in the end. And I'm going to give a very brief summary in the very end. Okay, so let me start by saying an increase to 45% offshore allowance allows for more efficient portfolios and greater diversification. Okay, and even before I start there, it's only positive. Okay, so our take on this change in regulation is only positive, and it actually starts one step before that. First of all, it's a good thing for South Africa. Okay, so we're living through times where you've got Russia potentially being uninvestable, where China is moving towards deglobalization, basically closing their economy more and more and more again. And us being part of the BRICS, we are sending a message, we are opening up. Okay, so for us, you can now take more money offshore. That is exactly the right sign. It's positive for the country. It should attract foreign investments. It's great in every instance. But then from here, one step further, it's also good for us as asset managers. Why? Because it only widens the opportunity set. Okay, so we've got more options. So we have this 100% allocate pie chart allocation, which we can move around, and now we can move it around in a more flexible way. So we should benefit. More important than us benefiting in our industry, though, is the South African saver is also better off because he can achieve a much more diversified portfolio. Okay, so there's a lot of benefits in this, and we think this is only positive. And we must always keep in mind, through exchange controls, we are forced to have a massive home bias. So I'll take, and then a little bit of a spoiler, is you should take 45% offshore. But if I take 45% offshore, I still have 55% in SA. So now bear in mind that if you really look at your portfolio from through the global lens, you are forced to have 55% in a portfolio, in a country allocation, which is globally less than 1% of global market cap. And in fact, our GDP is roughly 0.5% of global GDP. And you still have 55% of your retirement savings, for example, in this portfolio. So that in itself is already saying almost a no-brainer to go 45% offshore. Okay. Having said that, it's not all that easy. Okay. So there's challenges to it. So first of all, is our asset management industry fully equipped to go offshore? So some of the more pure passives or more index providers or asset managers which are closer to replicate an index, for them it's easy. And we saw some of them coming out that this is the best thing in the world. Let's go 45% offshore, because they can just move from replicating the top 40 to, or the all-share index to now replicating the S&P 500 or replicating the MSCI World. It's a good outcome. But what if you are like a stock picker and your core skill set is to really focus on South African shares? That's where you have your edge. Do you have the same edge if you now have to compete with the global asset managers in the global space? Do you even have a representation overseas? Are you equipped to achieve the same successes? That answer is not so easy. So there's constraints for industry, and it's important to highlight that. And then obviously some of our competitors will talk their book. I mean, we all buy it to some extent, so it's almost normal. But we must just be clear what is best, and that's what we're trying to work out there. Okay, increased exposure, increased offshore exposure leads to increased exchange rate risk. So if I now just take one step back and once again focus on the Citywire articles where some of our peers would say don't go 45% offshore, just go 40 or go 35, and most of them would say increase your offshore allocation, but why would they argue you're not 45? They would argue because you're taking on a lot of exchange risk. And that argument is 100% right. So we can't dispute that. Having said that, at present, we do think you should separate currency returns from asset class returns. And that is absolutely key. So I can be long the S&P 500, but I can choose whether if I'm long the S&P 500, I can choose whether I want to be long that index in rands or in dollars. I shouldn't muddle that decision. So I shouldn't choose the MSCI World or the S&P 500 because I'm positive on the dollar. Okay, those are two completely separate decisions, and it's actually quite easy to split that. And that's what we're saying is key, but in order to do that, you need currency hedging. Okay. Last point, which we're going to also cover in the end, is that actually we agree, and I said it earlier, we agree with the take that you shouldn't go 45% offshore if you can't do that differentiation. So if you want the max benefit of this 45% offshore allowance, if you want to have the max benefit of going max offshore, you need to look into currency hedging. Otherwise, you're taking on more risk than previously. Okay. So let's jump straight into it. What has actually changed? So this chart basically just summarizes what I said already earlier. The old regulation used to be you have, if I start on the right-hand side in the offshore space, you've got 10% of an extra Africa allowance. You've got then 30% for offshore X Africa allowance. So you can take it to 40 in combination if you take up the full 10% Africa, and then the rest has to be an SA. Okay, what has changed now is you can see that the slice which you have to be an SA has shrunk to 55%, and that Africa allowance has lumped into has been lumped into the offshore allowance, which means, once again, more flexibility. Okay, and this is, again, we think a good thing. It just widens and broadens your opportunity set. But we had quite there's different takes on this. And some of the discussions actually became partly also almost political. So some of our clients would say, because now we say we take 45% offshore, and then some of our clients would say, okay, but this is actually a bad change because you're supporting South Africa less, okay? Because you're actively taking money away from South Africa. You're investing less in South Africa. And also this take that the 10% Africa RSA allowance wrapping into the offshore allowance is also a bad thing because you're not supporting other African economies anymore. And the blunt answer, to be honest, which is not necessarily always what I'd say, but we have to do what's best for our clients. So we have a fiduciary duty. Our job is to work out what is the best for our client. And if we arrive at if we make a strong case, 45% offshore is the way to go, then we have to do that anyway. Okay. But other than that, I do not think that South Africa is worse off with this added offshore allowance. We are better off. It's a good sign, and there will be more investments attracted than which we will lose by basically allowing our investments to flow offshore. Okay, so I mentioned earlier that if you now decide to go 45% offshore, you're introducing a lot of currency risk, and you have to manage that. And a lot of our competitors would not necessarily feel that this is part of their skill set. Okay, so now you have to use derivatives, you have to get into the hedging space. It's not for everybody. But the reality is, if I buy an MSCI World in dollars and just hedge back the currency risk, I can do that with a listed future, I can do that without taking any added counterparty risk. There's no gearing, we're not allowed to gear anyway. There is literally no added risk, it's purely risk reducing. So we need to basically take into consideration that if we introduce an efficient way to diversify currency risk, it's risk reducing. It's nothing risky to do. It broadens our opportunity. In fact, it's a necessity to be able to move 45% offshore. Okay. And the currency volatility is something which has previously also been overlooked. Because in the past, it was quite easy, to be honest. So if I can only go 30% offshore, let's say I do not take up this 10% extra Africa allowance, then I can only take 30% offshore. Maybe I have to have 70% in SA anyway. Okay, so that's quite easy. So it's quite easy, and we saw that, and we've backed that out mathematically, that when we moved from 20 to 25 to 30% offshore allowance, it's very easy to go 30% offshore. You go max offshore because also you take global equities, and that's it. But now you move from the ability to go from 30 to 45, that's far more uncomfortable and far less of a no-brainer. Okay, so it's a much tougher decision. And also, you don't necessarily want to have 45% offshore equities. And most of our investors don't really like U.S. bonds. We've heard inflation is at 9.1, in fact, in the States, and our nominal yields are at 3. So it sounds like a terrible asset class for quite a few of us. Okay, so all of these points taken, but I want to highlight here another important point. It is key to also differentiate between what is right and good over the long term, i.e. your strategic asset allocation, and what is good over the short term. So we share that view. We're strongly negative on U.S. bonds, and we're strongly positive on SA bonds. We like SA equities much more than global equities, mostly for differences in valuations. So get all of that, and I share that view. But the one actually has nothing to do with the other. So we know that 96% of our returns are actually defined by a long-term strategic asset allocation, which is right. And we can have TIA views and everything, and we do play them actively, but you need to still get your starting point right, okay? And we shouldn't muddle that now there's more value in SA equities, SA bonds, I would argue even SA income assets, than in their global counterparts. But the reality is we must just not muddle this issue. Let's just be clear. So in this presentation, we're going to focus on the long term. What should you be doing in the long term? Okay, so I mentioned already earlier that if you drill down into the portfolios which our peers would be running, and they, before the change in regulation, they would hold roughly 30%, just below 30% global exposure, and that was mostly equity exposure. Okay, so if you look at that multi-asset high equity category, the guys would run with roughly 27, 28, 29% global equity exposure. That was easy, and they couldn't take more anyway, and we just put it in the MSCI World. Okay, or maybe stock pick in the MSCI World universe. Now the story becomes much tougher. Okay, so because now you say you can go 45%, but you don't really want 45% equity exposure, so now the decision becomes more difficult. And if I go into the low equity space, then naturally most of the industry would hold just less exposure in the offshore space because you're even more worried about currency risk. So that once again just highlights why don't go 45% offshore also in a conservative strategy. You also want the diversification. You also want to reduce the home bias. You also want to reduce the country-specific risk. But then just have a bigger currency risk. There's no risk to it. Okay, so what I'm trying to say here is, yes, we should move more offshore, but it's not always that easy, and there are certain biases. If we say we go 45%, we're very different to what we used to. And we also have to look into new asset classes now. So now we can't ignore the fact that 45% global equity is probably too much. So we need to look into it, we need to look into other asset classes globally as well, which is far more challenging, and not everybody has the skill set to do that. Okay, but let me take one step back, and this is actually a little bit of an academic exercise where we really run two mean variance optimizations. So we would take our own long-term expected returns, so our own long-term capital market assumptions, and we feed them into a simple mean variance framework. And we do not allow for currency hedging. Okay, so we do not allow for currency hedging. We just tell the optimization engine, this is no views of us involved, we just tell the optimization engine, give me the mean variance portfolio, which gives me CPI plus 6. What is that asset class mix supposed to look like? Forget about all my biases. Give me CPI plus 6 with the least possible risk, but you can only take 30% offshore, and after that, we're allowed to take 45% offshore. And then we compare the two portfolios. So the red is basically what a CPI plus 6 portfolio would have looked like, and this is probably pretty much, if you just focus on the red bars, pretty much in line with what our peers or the industry in general would have done. We arrive at more emerging market exposure, and the peer group is generally more comfortable with more DM exposure, but that's on the back of us assuming long-term emerging markets should have a risk premium to developed markets. But generally, this is a portfolio which should look familiar. If I focus on the offshore exposure, okay, we maxed it out at 30% because that's all we can do, and the mean variance framework would maximize that offshore allowance. So now we allow it with no currency hedging to take 45% offshore. So what would change? What would change is we reduce the SA equities exposure dramatically, and it all goes into EM equities, a little bit of SA bonds, a little bit more DM equities, and then we see that the offshore allocation moves from 30 to 40%. And this has come kind of like almost like a little bit of consensus. So most of the peers which took more offshore went from 30 to 35 to 40. Most of them have not gone to 45. And I guess rightfully so, because if you don't currency hedge, you shouldn't be 45. You're taking on too much currency risk. So this, the numbers, the data, the evidence points us exactly in that direction. Okay? So those are the takeaways I have highlighted. And just one thing to just reiterate here, the move away from South African equities into EM or DM equities, that's a quite important one for me, because in South Africa, not only do we have this 55% home bias, which is massive, on top of that, our equity index is highly concentrated. So I mean, we also prefer SA asset equities to DM equities, but actually it's a statement which one can easily challenge, because if you look into our equity market, we are so driven by two or three shares. We all know it's Naspers, and that's linked to Prosus, and Prosus and Naspers together make such a large portion of the market. And you've got two or three or four mines which are highly correlated, and then you've got the banks. So it's a highly, highly concentrated index with, if I'm optimistic, 100 names which are easily investable, probably less, and probably 10, 15, 20 which are really driving it. If I now just move SA equities into the combination of EM and DM equities, I end up with a couple of thousand names. So my idiosyncratic risk, which we know that from academic research, we don't get compensated for is massively reduced. So it's literally, there's not a lot of free lunches in investing, but this is a free lunch. You get much, much more diversification. You reduce your risk, and there's actually no downside to it. Okay. So I mentioned earlier also that we don't take up the 45% if we don't currency hedge. The currency risk is just too big. It introduces you more volatility than you're gaining through your diversification benefit. So then you shouldn't do it. And last but not least, what also stands out, there's no fixed income exposure, no developed market fixed income exposure taken up. So if I just go back one slide, you can see that there's SA bonds featuring here. There's no DM bonds featuring here. Okay? If I cannot currency hedge, our take is you should not have any developed market bonds. I'm going to drill into that just now a little bit more detailed why, but that asset class just remains unattractive if I cannot currency hedge. Okay, so those are the first takeaways. So let me just go a little bit more into detail now and speak about developed market bonds hedged and unhedged. Okay, if we just focus on the chart, the gray line is what the total return of developed market bonds. We're just using U.S. Treasuries here over the long term in dollars, okay? So if I take this time series, even if we don't like that asset class right now, and even if it has been volatile as of recent, it's generally like a haven asset, one of the asset classes which helps you a lot in a drawdown, one of the asset classes which we actually like from a correlation point of view. But if I convert this asset class into rands, this is what you basically get, the red line, it's just too volatile. So I mean, what is the expected return on a U.S. government bond? I mean, in real terms, if I'm optimistic, it's probably 1%. And for that asset class to be that volatile, the optimization will never choose it. Okay. So just inefficient. And that takes me once again. What are the key inputs to a mean variance framework? I mean, we all know that. The key inputs are expected returns, volatility, and correlations. What often is forgotten about is correlations is something which we often obsess about, but it's actually the least important. So the most important one is expected return, the second most important one is volatility, and the third important one is correlation. Okay, so which means that if you have an asset class like the red one, which has an expected real return of, let's call it 1%, but a massive volatility, it's unattractive. It's just you don't want it. But if I am just putting on top of that just a simple currency forward, I get exactly the same return, but I do not get the currency volatility, and I get that constant inflation interest rate differential between the rand and the dollar, then you end up with this gray, off-white, let me call it. That is an attractive profile now. So you don't leave the negative correlation against the equity market. So you still have a good hedge, but you've got far less volatility. You've got far less volatility, and you get the same expected return as an SA bond, slightly less because there's no emerging market risk premium, but you get a quite attractive asset class. So you just massively bring down the volatility. And that takes me, just jumping around a bit, sorry for that, but let me go two slides back. And just a quick reminder, we did not choose any DM bonds here. And the reason for that is the red line. But if I give that optimization engine the ability to now choose the off-white line, the story changes. Okay, so we're going to look into that just now as well. So before I go there, I just don't want to focus just on DM bonds, which is basically this one here. I also want to focus on all the other offshore asset classes. So what we're showing in this chart here on the x-axis is a slew of offshore asset classes, basically all the main ones which we think are investable and important. And then on the y-axis, we're showing the volatility of these asset classes. In the red line, you can see the volatility of these asset classes if they are not hedged. And in that yellowish off-white line, you will see the volatility of that asset class once it's currency hedged. Okay, let's start on the left-hand side. All of these asset classes here are the fixed income asset classes. Okay, you say DM cash, DM bonds, even DM high yield corporate bonds. All of these asset classes, if I do not currency hedge, are highly volatile. So all the whole dollar denominated fixed income world is like massively unattractive because you don't get the same expected returns as in the equity space, and your volatility is just super, super high. But if I currency hedge it, the volatility really goes away entirely. And now I have a whole set of new asset classes which I can access. Okay, so that's super important. Another important takeaway from this chart is if I focus on the right-hand side. So now I'm looking into the equity space. So we often have this misconception, global equities, I don't need to hedge. Because global equities, if the market sells off, then the rand blows out and I'm glad to be in dollars, so I get the dollar appreciation and it buffers me. Okay, it's partly true, but not entirely true. Okay, so it's partly true because what you can see is, other than in the fixed income space where you can see this massive difference between currency hedged and currency not hedged, you get a massive offsetting effect from the currency. So you can see that the volatility, whether currency hedged or not currency hedged, is very comparable. Okay, so you do get an embedded hedge, you do get a natural hedge in your offshore equity by the fact that if the equity market sells off, the rand usually tends to blow out and the dollar strengthens and you get the currency appreciation to buffer your losses. Okay, that does work. It only works to a certain extent. So if I look very carefully, very closely, you will see that the red line actually remains above the yellow line. So trying to say, even for global equities, if I currency hedge, you are actually reducing risk. There's one important element missing here, and that's obviously correlations. So I'm just looking at standard deviation through the whole time, so that as a little bit of a disclaimer. If we embed correlation in a very severe shock, probably there is a negative correlation and you do get the buffering effect. But we're not always in a crisis. Okay, so that's just important. Most of the time, we're actually not in the crisis. It doesn't feel like that. But most of the time, markets are not as volatile as they are right now. We just have a natural human bias to focus on the extremes. And we're not always in a crisis. And if we're not in a crisis, you have equities, especially global equities, sometimes having a quite smooth bull market. And during that time, your rand volatility is added and actually causes choppiness. And hedging that out doesn't make sense. So there's a case for hedging massively in the offshore fixed income space, but also in the offshore equity space. And just on that point, I guess it's important to highlight that not only are we not always in a crisis, but it also depends on the nature of the crisis. So if we are heading towards an inflationary crisis, like what we've been through, not I wouldn't call it the last month or two, but the period before. We had an extended period of extreme market weakness, but the rand was actually strengthening. Why that? Because now we have stronger commodity prices, and that's actually good for the South African equity market. Okay, so the rand, the dollar was a particularly poor hedge, just as of now. We've forgotten about that already again, because the crisis which we're facing now is a different one. We're now pricing for a global recession. And in that period, the rand fell off and the dollar strengthened and the hedge works again. But it's not crisis independent. So I'm trying to say the dollar works as a hedge, but it's not a very good hedge. So unfortunately, the answer is not as simple. You want some currency hedging definitely in the fixed income space. And when it comes to the equity space, there's arguments in both directions. I'm not saying you should hedge all your offshore equity exposure, but you also shouldn't hedge none of it. It's a very complex exercise. And what we are doing is that we are allowing the optimization engines to mathematically back out what is the sharpest combination, what is the most efficient way to create a portfolio, take into account all the moving parts, and also allowing the optimization engines to currency hedge if it's beneficial. Okay, so that's also a mouthful, as it was called earlier. At least I've got some slides to help me a little bit. Okay, so just to bring it back and summarize what I've just said, 45% offshore allocation is good, but you need to look into currency hedging, absolutely key. And secondly, especially the fixed income assets classes will benefit massively if you introduce the ability to currency hedge. Okay, so that basically takes me to another slide, which is a little bit of the conclusion of what I've just said now. We are now once again looking at the same two portfolios as previously. We're looking in red, the previous offshore limits, no currency hedging. So that's the red bar, again, unchanged. Then we're looking at this yellowish bar, no offshore limits, no currency hedging. You can see we do take on more dollar exposure, but we don't take on the full amount. And now we're introducing a whole new portfolio. We're saying, use all these asset classes again, but now you can get access in dollars or in rand. So you can basically buy DM bonds or DM equities or EM bonds or EM equities or high yielding credit bonds in dollars, and you buy that asset class mix, and then you can freely choose whether currency hedging or not. Let's just have the numbers and the facts talk and let the data speak, so to say. And if you do that, you get the gray portfolio. So what happens in the gray portfolio is that you can see that all of a sudden there is DM bonds starting to stick out their head, okay? Because now this asset class, now I can currency hedge it. Now it starts to become attractive. I don't have to just use the dollar because it's the only haven asset I have. I can now basically start to use DM bonds as well as a haven asset. And now I've got two diversifiers which are helping me in a risk-off environment. Okay, so you can see that DM bonds start to stick their head off, and you can see that the currency hedge comes into play. Okay, so now basically telling us, yes, go 45% offshore. So if I combine the dollar exposure and the dollar hedged exposure, so offshore but hedged back to rands, I will end up with 45%. So you can see that the rand exposure basically drops to the lowest. Okay, get DM bonds in the mix, get a hedge into the mix, and just have a superior asset class mix in general. And interesting, you can see that SA equity exposure, again, it's down from the previous peak. But where does it go if I compare it to the red line? It basically goes into DM equities, and it basically just gives me a much, much more broader diversified portfolio. Okay. So just to summarize what I just said, and if I really now put it together into a portfolio, how would that new portfolio look, and what would the conclusions thereof be? Conclusion is you would take the full offshore allocation. You would not take it if you can't currency hedge. If you can currency hedge, you would take the full offshore allowance. You remove idiosyncratic risks as strongly as you can. You reduce your home bias. You still have to have 55% in SA, which is a lot. But you at least take the 45% off offshore exposure, and you hedge. And we say you should hedge roughly 15%. Okay, so 45% goes offshore. 15% roughly is hedged back into rands. So we're not saying currency hedging is the way to go. You must just hedge all your offshore exposure. The answer is more complex. And I've, with a few of you, we've been in touch quite extensively on this matter. I can just encourage everybody to reach out if you want to have a more detailed presentation from us on this. But what the conclusion is really that you should go offshore 45, but you should partly currency hedge and not all of it. So 45% offshore, 15% currency hedged means we still like to have 25, 30% dollar exposure. So we like the dollar as a hedge. It's not the only thing which you want to rely on. Okay, we want to basically eliminate a lot of SA equity exposure. And that basically goes straight offshore into DM and EM equity exposure. And that's a very strong call. And again, it just means moving from 100 names into a couple of thousand names. Simple diversification benefit. I would like to much more put the expected returns, attach them to the likelihood of an MSCI World or MSCI Emerging Market to outperform than just relying on NASPERS or CFR or you name it. It's just too risky. So you want that broad opportunity set, and we would almost call this a free lunch. And then we would also say that the SA bond exposure, I mean Melanie said it, and we share exactly that view. We are very optimistic on SA bonds with a yield of 12 and an inflation target of 4.5. We're not at 4.5 now, but they're probably still going to give us CPI plus 5 over the years to come if yields don't come down. So very, very, very much like SA bonds tactically. But tactically and strategically are two different things. You should still strategically differentiate and start to look into offshore asset classes, for example, like developed market bonds, because you can take away the currency volatility and the asset class becomes attractive. Okay, so where is the industry most likely headed? I guess this is a little bit of a misstating the fact. I guess what we want to say here more is what do we think is the way to go. We do the industry actually through time. It just takes a while, but it's actually quite good in working out the optimal from a mean variance framework. So probably this is pretty close where a lot of our peers will arrive. What we think a portfolio should look like in the CPI plus 6 space would be this. Okay, so if you compare it to the starting points, we are introducing DM bonds, SA equities. This feels super low. So if you look at our multi-asset, the FCSA multi-asset high equity category, a CPI plus 6 portfolio carries roughly 40, 45, 50% SA equities. Okay, that's what we're used to. So this is a little bit out of the ordinary. So what this means is massively less SA equities. But where does it go? It goes into the offshore equity space. So we're not necessarily suggesting to have risky assets, less risky assets. You need those risky assets to arrive at CPI plus 6, but you can diversify nicely. And you should. This asset class is if we have to have 70% in SA, this is the only asset class we can rely on to give us CPI plus 6. It's not that we have options, but it's still a highly concentrated asset class. So if I can move away into alternative asset classes which still give me a similar expected return, I would definitely do so. And it's not about what I would do, but again, these numbers are straight from an optimization engine and suggest that this is a risk-reducing move. And then on the currency side, I mentioned earlier, we still like to have a lot of unhedged dollar exposure. So it's not that we will hedge all our offshore exposure, but balance it out. 45% is too much. You still want this diversification benefit, so you need this part of currency hedging. Okay, so this basically summarizes everything. It's just 15 slides. I thought I would go much too fast, but I get quite passionate about it quickly, so normally I take longer than what I plan to. So what's a summary? So the biggest differentiator that we see in this regime shift will be that even more focus needs to be given to asset allocation. Okay, that's obviously exactly down our alley because we are more top-down, macroeconomic, systematic-driven at present. So for us, this was like the best thing which could happen. But having said that, we think that the ability to move this pie chart around now has increased. And asset allocation is really definitive of your long-term investment success. It's not the stock picking and it's not the market timing. Both of them add more noise than value. Okay? So because of that, we do think asset allocation has been the most important decision in investments always, and that is now for South African investors even more pronounced because you can move your pie chart around more flexible. Okay, secondly, stock picking becomes more difficult because you don't have options. Like if you only have 30% offshore and you've got 70% in SA, I might as well focus on the 70% SA and put the 30% in an MSCI World Index. But it's not good enough if you really have the ability to take 45%. I don't know if you deserve to earn a high management fee if you just put 45% in an index. And anyway, maybe the management fee is low, but I'm just trying to say stock picking becomes tougher unless you are as good in the global space as you are in the South African space. But that's a tough thing to say because it's a very, very, very competitive space and there's just a lot of efficiency going on. So it's much, much tougher for a South African manager to have an edge in the global space than to have an edge in the South African space. Okay, so that's just something to bear in mind. And then we want to highlight the fact of having a dynamic strategic asset allocation is important. So strategic is long-term and tactical is short-term. At present, we do both dynamic TAA and SAA. But TAA is obvious, we want to take tilts and all of that. But SAA must also be dynamic. And what we mean by that is there's a change in regulation and you must change your view. So that's what John Maynard Keynes used to say back in the days, when the facts change, I change my view. Unfortunately, the reality. So a strategic asset allocation is long-term. And it's a long-term, and we take a 30-year view on the SAA. But now I can be like 45 instead of 30. I must react. I must be dynamic. I can't have a set and zone strategic asset allocation, and that's it. So the way we go about investing, as you know, Preston, very systematic. For us, it took less than a week to work out the new optimal, and we made the switch. So that's what is important. You need to be dynamic. So it's towards active investing and not passive investing. Okay. Yeah, that's basically everything from my side. A lot on currency hedging, a lot of taking more money offshore, but more money offshore while being positive on SA. Okay, it's not about we talk a lot to trustees, and generally there's a massive negative bias towards South Africa, always being negative on SA. At the same point in time, we are forced to have a lot in SA. Our approach is different. Let's remove those biases. Let's take a step back and say, we're actually positive on SA, but you still shouldn't have more than 55% of your portfolio in this one very concentrated country. So you can be very optimistic on SA, but strive for diversification. It is the only free lunch, and build a smarter portfolio. And include currency hedging because it's a necessity to reap the benefits. Okay, thank you.
Awesome. Please give it up for Bastian. Thank you so much. I see my German brother here. I really believe you when you say you love South Africa, because, you know, when I was looking at the time, I'm like, this guy's German. 30 minutes, it's going to happen on the month. Is you even taking our culture here? I love to see it. So because of that, I only have two questions, please. My sister, one, and then my brother over there, two.
Research has shown us that your results are net of the cost of hedging as well. So has that been included in it? And I see you have high components towards emerging markets offshore. How do you manage to hedge that and cost effectively still contribute to your overall risk return profile?
Yeah. So good question. So is it gross or net of cost? So for that, we need to take one step back and think about what is the long-term. Again, everything is long-term, so it's strategic. What is your long-term cost of currency hedging? I'm not talking options and asymmetric payoff profiles. I'm just literally talking converting with a forward, straightforward, a dollar investment into a rand investment. So if I do that over the long-term, what do I earn? Over the long-term, I earn exactly the interest rate differential. Okay, so let's say interest rates in South Africa is 6%. In the States, it's 2%, so I lock in 4%. Simple as that. The rand is now at 17. If I do the hedge, I can basically sell dollars and already receive 17.5. Okay, so I already get the benefit of the interest rate differential, and that basically compensates for the long-term currency deflation. So we know the rand is going to weaken over time, but it is going to be exactly in line with the interest rate differential. So that's what purchasing power parity, the Fisher equation, all of these theories suggest, is your long-term depreciation of the rand, which is going to happen, is going to be in line with the benefit of your currency hedge. Okay, so it means from an expected return point of view, there's no difference. Okay, it just means you're reducing volatility. And in terms of cost, so if I strike a forward with one of the global banks, as we usually do, so if I trade a dollar rand forward with JP Morgan, Goldman, whatever, it literally is often less than a basis point in terms of what the costs are. So in all honesty, it's before taking costs into consideration, but it's literally neglectable. So it's less than 10 bips for a year. Sorry, emerging markets. Okay, so the emerging market, we invest on an index level, but by using basically synthetic index exposure. So we basically invest into the MSCI emerging markets. The MSCI emerging market is dollar denominated. So that makes it very easy. So we get the currency mixed in there, but the end product is dollar denominated. So all we have to do is hedge dollars to rand. So super easy, super efficient, and at very low cost. So quite easy for us to do that. If I would be using all the individual currencies, it becomes difficult. Yeah. Sorry, the second one, yeah.
Morning, thanks. Where you've got local South African liabilities, I noticed that there's an additional layer of volatility by still having this exposure to the US dollar. So what benefit do you get out of that, the unhedged part?
Yeah, okay, that's also a good point. You don't get any benefit in the fixed income space. You basically don't get any benefit. So if we would only have DM equities, EM equities as part of our opportunity set, we probably would be if we only would have DM bonds as part of our opportunity, we would currency hedge everything. But as soon as we have DM equities, and you're speaking about liabilities, you probably use offshore equities to match your long-term liabilities, you can then basically have an unhedged portion because there are correlation advantages. So if you see a massive sell-off in, for example, global equities, very often the rand does in fact weaken. So we don't dispute that correlation benefit. We actually want to use it. That's why there is an unhedged portion. We just say, hang on there, 45% of that is too much. Cool stuff.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody.
Bastian, thank you so much. Thanks. Please give him a round of applause.